Hello, it's Friday the 17th of April. My name's John Dennis. Today, the Commons Speaker Michael Martin is under pressure after the Crown Prosecution Service says it won't press charges against the MP Damian Green.
Some of the information leaked undoubtedly touched on matters of legitimate public interest, which were reported in the press. I have therefore decided that there is insufficient evidence for a realistic prospect of conviction against Mr. Galli or Mr. Green.
Also today, after 10 years, Russia ends its counter-terrorist operations in Chechnya.
Chechnya has become kind of quasi-independent, and the fact that this anti-terrorist regime is now finished in Chechnya means that Kadyrov can really do what he wants.
And Barack Obama visits Mexico, where the violent war with drug cartels is spilling over into the United States.
It's complicated the vision of Obama here, but he's hugely popular.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about any of that, here's Bill Overton with the news and a look at the papers.
Four top secret memos detailing torture techniques which the CIA was allowed to use under President George W. Bush have been made public by Barack Obama. Methods including sleep deprivation and waterboarding were sanctioned for use on Al-Qaeda and other suspects held at Guantanamo Bay and secret detention centres around the world. However, President Obama has ruled out legal action against those involved in carrying out such procedures. He says it's a time for reflection, not retribution. The Home Office is launching a review of the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, the so-called Snoopers Charter, which regulates surveillance methods used by local councils. The Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, says authorities should not use their powers to target minor offences, such as dogs fouling pavements. The Act does allow the use of covert methods, like hidden cameras, to target benefit cheats, but councils have been accused of using them for petty crimes too. The Tories and Lib Dems say the Act needs urgent reform. Meanwhile, Jackie Smith's still under fire after Damian Green was cleared of any wrongdoing in the Home Office leaks inquiry. It's emerged that Mr. Green was told during the 9 hours of detention following his arrest last November that he could face life imprisonment. He's refused to call for Ms. Smith's resignation, but says he believes in the Italian proverb, fish rots from the head, and also that she created the atmosphere in the Home Office which led to his arrest. The leader of a Thai protest movement which brought down former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra last year has been shot and injured in Bangkok. Sondi Linthongkul, head of the People's Alliance of Democracy, was travelling to a TV studio when his car was hit by gunfire. He suffered minor injuries while his driver's been more seriously hurt. It follows recent clashes between supporters of Shinawatra and Thai police. Bangkok is reported to be calm but under heavy security. Sport and Manchester City's hopes of ending their 33-year wait for a trophy have been dashed, although they scored a 2-1 victory in the UEFA Cup quarter-final second leg against Hamburg. They've crashed out of the competition 4-3 on aggregate. Let's take a look at the papers now, and three front pages will make unhappy reading for Jackie Smith. The Daily Mail credits the Home Secretary with another fine mess, reporting the whistleblower at the heart of the leak inquiry places her at the centre of the row. Christopher Galli insists Ms. Smith must have approved police involvement in the case. Smith under fire as Tory MP is cleared over leaks, is the Guardian's headline, while The Telegraph states Jackie Smith's job's on the line. The paper says that with her already being at the centre of multiple expenses rows, she is a prime candidate to be reshuffled later in the year. The Independent claims an exclusive on what's happening in Somalia. It says while the media focuses on the escapades of the country's pirates, back on dry land there's a silent exodus as civilians flee the anarchic state, creating the world's biggest refugee camp across the border in neighbouring Kenya. The front page of The Times carries a tribute to the late Sir Clement Freud, giving prominence to his famous quote, "If you give up drinking, smoking, loving, you don't live longer, it just seems like it." Also on page one, that story about local councils, and there's a more detailed look at the issue further inside under the headline "Trivial Pursuits That Turned the Town Hall Snoopers into Tyrants." The tabloids, meanwhile, are following some trivial pursuits of their own. The Mirror leads on the story of Susan Boyle, the latest star to be born from Britain's Got Talent. Simon Cowell's apparently been ordered by fellow judge Amanda Holden to leave hair alone. Miss Holden says that a glossy makeover for the 47-year-old Scottish churchgoer would strip her of her originality. And The Sun claims on its front page that Gordon Ramsay's having a kitchen nightmare of his own. The Red Top says the TV chef is serving up pre-made meals at several of his trendy and expensive restaurants. More news and comment throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
In November last year, the Tory immigration spokesman Damian Green was arrested. Police raided his home and his office in the House of Commons. There had been a series of leaks from the Home Office to Mr. Green, including revelations about illegal immigrants and Jackie Smith's warning that the recession could boost crime levels. But now the Crown Prosecution Service says neither Green nor the civil servant who leaked the documents will face charges. The Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, denied the Home Office had presided over a Keystone Cops operation by the police. The decision to take no further action against Damian Green puts pressure on the Commons Speaker, Michael Martin, and his officials. Columnist Martin Kettle says Martin faces some difficult questions.
Well, I think his position is really very weak now. I mean, I think he's been very negligent. It's clear that when the police came, he didn't really pay attention to the question. He didn't step up to the plate. He just let officials sort it out. And it was a very serious precedent. And especially now that no prosecution is going to take place, that leaves the Speaker looking even weaker than he did before. I think it's simply a matter of when he goes, not whether he goes. I guess he'll want to stay on until the end of the current Parliament. That's just over a year. But actually, I think he should go now. I think it's a very serious error on his part.
Does this further weaken the authority of the Home Secretary, Jackie Smith?
I think she doesn't come very well out of it. And of course, she's not in a very strong position anyway because of all her expenses issues and so on. So she's politically vulnerable. She clearly didn't ask the sensible question at the right time. I mean, clearly this was an issue which she as Home Secretary would know about to some degree. You know, this is one of the main opposition frontbench spokesmen getting leaks and making life difficult for the government because of them. She should, I think, have taken a grip on this question too. So she's not come out of this looking very good. But it's the civil servants, I think, who, as the preemptively protective report from the Home Affairs Select Committee made clear, it's the civil servants who really, I think, overreacted by calling in the Metropolitan Police and setting off the train of events which led to the arrest of the civil servant and the questioning of Damian Green in his house and in his office.
And it's a further blow to the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Paul Stevenson.
Paul Stevenson had a real baptism of fire with the G20 allegations about mistreatment of protesters and obviously the death of Mr. Tomlinson. But, I mean, he really has got to get a grip on the Metropolitan Police. This is a big issue. London's police force is easily the most important and powerful in the country. And at the moment, it seems to be, you know, kicking the doors down rather than following the law.
Another Damian making the news at the moment, Martin, is Damian McBride. He resigned at the weekend over a series of emails with the blogger Derek Draper over attempts to smear senior Tories. And the Prime Minister said sorry for this yesterday. This is what Gordon Brown said.
Well, I'm sorry about what happened. I've said all along that when I saw this first, I was horrified, I was shocked, and I was very angry indeed. I think the most important thing we do is reassure people that everything is being done to clean up politics in our country.
Martin Kettle, what do you make of that?
I think it's quite significant. Gordon Brown is somebody who has to have apologies, pulled out of him like teeth being extracted. He does not like saying sorry. He thinks it's a sign of weakness. He thinks it's a campaign against him by his opponents, which, of course, in part it is. So I think it's quite significant that he did say sorry on this, because I think he does recognise at some level that this is very, very damaging. And it kind of stands in the way of him being able to get onto the high ground where he would like to be on issues like the economy, the G20, and indeed everything else to do with the election agenda and the attempt to get Labour re-elected. I think his apology doesn't really go far enough myself. He is still in the sort of Lee Harvey Oswald mould, where he's saying, you know, it was one man acting alone, which I think is fundamentally implausible for those of us who have followed Gordon Brown's politics over the last decade and more. But nevertheless, an apology is an apology, and one shouldn't be churlish about it. He did the right thing.
Does it draw a line under the affair?
I think it doesn't draw a line under the affair. This is going to run and run. It is said there are going to be a lot of Labour emails in the Sunday papers leaked to them. That's going to presumably have an accelerating effect. It's not going to go away. And I think all of these things to do with political process, which includes obviously MPs' expenses and questions of party political funding, and in Labour's case, the links between Gordon Brown's office and the trade unions who pay the checks, which allows Labour to put the lights on at the moment. I mean, all of these things are just dead weight politically. There's no gain in them at all. So I think it's going to continue unless and until Gordon Brown can really exert real leadership and be proactive about this and really break out of it. And maybe that will happen. But the experience of the Brown premiership so far is that he takes a long time to make up his mind and doesn't act decisively.
Martin Kettle. Well, following the resignation of Damian McBride and Gordon Brown's apology for his actions, Derek Draper's position as editor of the Labour List website is looking shaky. Former Sunday Times editor Andrew Neil presents the BBC programme The Daily Politics. He told Matt Wells on our Media Talk podcast about a televised encounter between Draper and the Tory blogger Paul Staines, alias Guido Fawkes, the man who exposed McBride and Draper's scandalous emails.
We had Derek Draper and Guido Fawkes, also known as Paul Staines, on The Daily Politics last month to argue about blogging and about their respective sites and about the importance of blogging. Of course, it quickly turned into a wrestling match. And in the process of the interview, I asked Derek Draper if there was any official Labour contact with his site, if the Labour Party was officially involved. And he denied it. And then Guido Fawkes said, "But I have information that links Damian McBride to you and your blogging activities." And that was then the first hint of what Guido Fawkes had up his sleeve. And also, as we subsequently learned, an indication that Mr. Draper was perhaps, in answering my question, economical with the truth.
As a former newspaper editor yourself, what do you think this tells us about the state of blogging and its relation to political journalism?
I think it tells what the Americans call the mainstream media, MSM, both broadcasters and newspapers and magazines alike, that blogging is making a big difference to the way news and opinion and scoops are disseminated. We've seen it with the Daniel Hannan YouTube appearance when he spoke in the European Parliament, which the main broadcasters decided wasn't a story. The bloggers and the internet decided otherwise. It became a huge international story as a result. And we've seen that the bloggers can now get scoops that the rest of the newspapers and the broadcasters have to follow up. In many ways, people like you and me, who've set the agenda in the past for news and opinion, are no longer fully in control the way we were. There are new kids in town, and it's a democratization in many ways of the process of news and analysis and opinion. I welcome it, and I think we're heading for the first ever broadband blogging general election.
What about this idea that Labour seems to have lost its knack when it comes to spin? Because you talked about control there and loss of control. They seem to have tried to control this affair, but failed miserably.
Yes, there's been a lack of subtlety, and I think taking a sledgehammer to crack a nut in many ways. I think if you just do it for so long, in the end you become stale at it. Plus, I think we are more up to their tricks. I mean, I think there's no question when Mr. Blair came to power in 97, with Alistair Campbell at his side, that the mainstream media was kind of intimidated by Mr. Blair's popularity, which was enormous, and by Mr. Campbell's, rather robust methods of trying to control the press, backed up by Mr. Mandelson, who used to call broadcasters almost the moment a major newscast had begun to complain about the running order or about a particular slant on a story. I think we've just got a bit long in the tooth about it all. We know their tricks. We're less intimidated by them. Indeed, we're a bit bored by them, and we stand up a bit more to them.
Andrew Neil, and there's more in our Media Talk podcast at guardian.co.uk/podcast. audio. And The Guardian's audio output, including Guardian Daily and Media Talk, has been nominated in the Webby Awards, that's the Internet Oscars. You can vote for us in the People's Voice category at webbyawards.com. Also on The Guardian's website today, Michelle Hanson, a former entrant of the Alternative Miss World, on what the competition is all about at guardian.co.uk/women. How to be a trend spotter. I've got a feeling I've read a number of articles on that theme recently at guardian.co.uk/lifeandstyle for the most recent one. And for 20 years, Warp Records has been wrecking clubbers' eardrums and delighting fans of electronic music. Dave Simpson celebrates the pioneering Sheffield label at guardian.co.uk/music. In 1999, Russia's Prime Minister Vladimir Putin sent troops into Chechnya, winning back the region from separatists who'd been in control since the 1994-96 war. Well, for the last 10 years, the Kremlin has imposed a security regime of arbitrary arrests, roadblocks, curfews, and restrictions on journalists. Luke Harding's in Moscow for The Guardian. He told me why Russia's National Anti-Terrorist Committee yesterday ended its counter-terrorism operations in Chechnya.
Ramzan Kadyrov, the president of Chechnya, who's a close ally of Vladimir Putin, Russia's prime minister, has been really demanding this for some time. And it's a fascinating move because essentially it means that Kadyrov is now wholly in control of Chechnya. The sort of federal security forces, about 20,000 policemen and soldiers, withdrawing. And I think the most interesting thing about this decision is that really, in a way, although Chechnya is still formally part of Russia, part of the Russian Federation, and Kadyrov, you know, is often pictured with Putin and portrays himself as a loyalist. But in real terms, Chechnya has become kind of quasi-independent. And the fact that this anti-terrorist regime is now finished in Chechnya means that Kadyrov can really do what he wants, including, as we've seen recently, allegedly selling sort of death squads to murder his enemies. So in some ways, it's good news for Chechnya. It means the return, you know, of stability, if you like, and the formal end of the war. But in other respects, I think it enhances Ramzan Kadyrov's power to a dangerous extent.
Is everyone inside the Russian government happy with Kadyrov?
Well, again, that's very interesting. I've just been talking to a Russian former major and veteran who fought in the First Chechen War in the mid-1990s and who knew many of the sort of dead Chechen separatist leaders, all of whom have been wiped out. And what he said to me was, why did all these people die? Tens of thousands of people died in this conflict, Chechen civilians, Russian soldiers, conscripts, and so on. And what he was saying was that, in fact, now if you look at who's actually running Chechnya, they're all ex-separatist leaders. What Vladimir Putin did after essentially winning the Second Chechen War after 1999 was he gave power to a group of former separatists. And the deal was essentially that they would run Chechnya and sort of make it stable again while sort of formally being loyal to Moscow. But in return, they'd be granted sort of considerable autonomy to do more or less what they wanted and to sort of settle all sorts of local scores. Now, in a sense, this veteran major is right. A lot of people died. The result is that Chechnya is formally part of Russia, but essentially it's got the kind of autonomy that these separatist leaders in the 90s, you know, were fighting for.
Luke Harding. I'm John Dennis. You're listening to Guardian Daily. Still to come, Peter Capaldi, star of In the Loop, on life imitating art.
I'd never really played a part where someone was so aggressive and so verbally aggressive, and I had to try and think in my head, who did I know in my own life that was actually like that?
But first, President Barack Obama is in Mexico. He's eager to establish warm relations with the United States' southern neighbour. Jo Tuckman's in Mexico City for The Guardian. She says the main focus of Obama's trip is the drug war.
It's quite a delicate issue. I mean, it's a delicate issue in Mexico because it is so fierce and so many people have died, about 6,000, over 6,000 just last year alone. But it's been spilling over into the US, and Washington at the beginning of the year kind of woke up to how serious an issue this was. And several fairly high-ranking officials started to imply that the Mexican government wasn't in control. The Mexican government or President Felipe Calderón got upset at this, and kind of as a result, there's been this series of high-ranking people from the Obama administration coming, culminating in Obama himself today.
And this is Obama's first visit to Latin America as president. How is he regarded in Mexico?
He's extremely popular in Mexico. He's charismatic, and he's a vision of the future. It's a bit more complicated. Always the attitude to the U.S. and all things from there is complicated in Mexico, because he's come here to show support for Felipe Calderón, who's a right-wing president, and he's come here to show support for Felipe Calderón's battle against the cartels, which the left in Mexico largely views as misguided and counterproductive. So it's complicated, the vision of Obama here, but that he's hugely popular, he is.
Does President Calderón and Obama share the same view of how to defeat the drugs cartels?
Obama has said some very nice things about Calderón in the last few weeks. He calls him heroic, he calls him, you know, courageous. He's here explicitly to show solidarity for these moves. But the suspicion is that behind the scenes there's all sorts of other pressure going on Calderón to at least adapt his military focus strategy in the drug wars, not least what is it, the person who is expected to be named as the new ambassador to Mexico is a guy called Carlos Pascual, who made his name in the whole theory around the concept of failed states, which is something obviously that Felipe Calderón rejects out of hand.
You mentioned that the US administration has only just really woken up to this problem. What was George Bush's approach to the drugs wars?
He did visit Mexico, and he did, in fact, sign an aid agreement with Felipe Calderón called the Merida Initiative, which amounts to basically $1.4 billion over 3 years of aid to help fighting the drug traffickers. But they didn't really seem to make it a priority. I mean, the priorities were elsewhere in the world for the U.S., as they were for Obama during the campaign. I mean, Mexico and the drug wars didn't figure. Why they've suddenly woken up to it now? Well, it got worse, particularly towards the end of the year, last year. The level of the violence and the brutality, the horror of the violence got that much worse and that much more intense. So that's one of the reasons. Then there were a whole series of reports. There was a U.S. military report that compared Mexico to Pakistan as a state that was in danger of essentially imploding. So there were all sorts of factors around it. And then there was this reaction in Mexico by President Calderón to these questionings of his strategy that prompted this series of high-level visits, and, you know, including Hillary Clinton last night.
Joe Tuckman. In the Loop has been hailed as the best British comedy film for decades. Directed by Armando Iannucci and using characters from his TV series The Thick of It, the film is a political satire of the spin and the incompetence that went on behind the scenes in the build-up to the Iraq War. Reviewing the film in yesterday's Guardian, Peter Bradshaw said the acting is superb and the writing is relentlessly funny. And refreshingly, there isn't a sympathetic character in sight. Peter Capaldi plays the Downing Street media director Malcolm Tucker. Well, the critics like it, but Capaldi told Jason Solomons in our Film Weekly podcast of his mother's reaction to the film.
Well, it's really a shame. I brought my mother to a screening in Glasgow. In fact, Amanda brought his mother as well, and they all sat down the front. And I'm sure they were very proud. Well, I know my mother was very proud to see her son on the screen, but I'm sure she would have preferred, you know, that I was in Four Weddings and a Funeral or something instead of this foul-mouthed beast who was screaming all over the screen. But she was still, she said she liked it.
So she said, John Hannah, why couldn't you be like that nice John Hannah?
Why couldn't you be like that nice John Hannah? Look what I gave birth to. You know? But at least it's still showbiz, isn't it?
Absolutely. It is a terrific performance, Peter.
Thank you.
Just talks about the creativity creation of Malcolm Tucker, because obviously it started on Thick of It in television. We get to see more of him, which is what I like, more monstrous version of him in the film in The Loop. Is it something that Armando and you kind of created together, or did you just see it on the page and think this is how it's to be played?
Well, really, it's a sort of combination of all of those elements. I mean, ultimately, it's Armando and the writers who come up with the plots and with the lines. So I try to inhabit those as interestingly as I can. And often, you know, it's a very plot-driven show, and plot-driven film. So it's quite hard to kind of infuse it with a kind of emotional side to it, which is kind of my job. I've got to try and make it look as if this is, in some way, shape, or form, a real person. Mm. But to answer the question, I guess, you know, the writers really come up with most of the concept of the character, but we flesh it out. And I guess it's evolved as well. I mean, because I've been playing him for 4 years, and there are other aspects of him that you perhaps don't see so much in the film, which in the early versions of the show, he used to be sort of much more Machiavellian and darker.
He was more Machiavellian than a man pulling the strings and making war happen at the UN.
Yes, but what I mean was he was more kind of secretively manipulative.
Right.
As opposed to vocally, bullying people. But now he does both. I'd never really played a part where someone was so aggressive and so verbally aggressive. And I had to try and think in my head, who did I know in my own life that was actually like that? And to be honest, the only people I came up with were American producers and agents. For instance, the Weinsteins,
Yeah. You
know, are very like that. They're very kind of verbose and aggressive, but funny. You know, very, very witty, but tough guys, you know, who use a lot of street language and are able to come in the next day as if the bollocking they gave you yesterday never happened.
Yeah.
So I sort of drew on a lot of my experience of those guys.
Yeah, you must be delighted that this week, of all weeks, the film's actually being released. I know it's been a long sort of promotional haul since Sundance and Glasgow and Dublin and all that, but now it's coming released in Damien McBride week, in the week of, just week after Jackie Smith's husband and his worrying about porn. Do you think that's just happenstance, or do you think that the film is actually so chock full of those kind of relevances that it's always going to be a week where something pertains in the film to real life?
I don't know. I think it's absolutely uncanny. I mean, all this Damien McBride stuff is so kind of Tucker-esque and so kind of the language that he uses is so similar to Tucker as well. I think Armando must have a crystal ball somewhere, you know, where he sees these things about to happen. Or perhaps it's what it is probably is that, you know, the culture of politics that we think is there is not the one that's there. We think the one that's there is the one that the newspapers tell us or the media tells us, but there's a secret one, which is between the politicians, their spin doctors, and the media, you know, which they all collude in. And that's the sort of area that we are trying to uncover and play around in.
Yeah.
And I think that's always there and always has been.
Peter Capaldi, and there's more from him and Jason Solomons in Film Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio. Guardian Daily was produced today by Phil Maynard and Doug Hardy. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.